Hello. My name is Dr. Mercurio Arborea, and I am the founder of the Arborea Institute. Through our unique blend of benign pharmacology, sensory therapy, and energy sculpting, we can guide you to a new, better, happier you. You are about to embark on a great journey. Let the new age of enlightenment begin.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order.
It's no longer a theory. What I'm about to say is fact. The secret organizations of the world power elite are no longer secret. They have planned and are now leading us into a one world communist government.
Welcome, useless eaters, to the Odd Man Out podcast, where we talk about hidden history, depolitical policy, occult deconstruction, economics, religion, and philosophy. I'm your rabbit hole aficionado, the Odd Man. Welcome.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order.
Public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
And when that first cocaine was smuggled in on a ship, it may as well have been a deadly bacteria so much as it hurt the body, the soul of our country. But take my word for it, this scourge will stop.
What's shaking, oddities? Welcome to another The Odd Man Out podcast. I hope that you're doing well, and as always, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me. This week, going to be looking at the Democracy Propaganda series once more with part two. If you heard part one, we mainly focused on Edward Bernays' predecessor, Walter Lippmann. We will be briefly mentioning Lippmann again in this episode, but we're going to go back a little bit further into history with a few other characters who studied crowds, herd mentality and propaganda, even before Lippmann and Edward Bernays. And first of all, we're going to be looking at a quote from Charles McKay from his book from 1841. It was called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And he said this, kind of summing up his studies on crowds. In reading the history of nations, we find that like individuals, they have their own whims, their peculiarities, their seasons of excitement and recklessness, when they care not what they do. We find that whole communities suddenly fix their minds upon one object and go mad in its pursuits. That millions of these people become simultaneously impressed with one delusion and run after it till their attention is caught by some new folly more captivating than the first. Men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds as well, while they only recover their senses slowly, one by one. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Because we really haven't changed that much over time. The crowd mind is the crowd mind.
I love people as I meet them one by one. People are just wonderful as individuals. You see the whole universe in their eyes if you look carefully. But as soon as they begin to group, as soon as they begin to clot, when there are five of them or ten, or even groups as small as two, they begin to change. They sacrifice the beauty of the individual for the sake of the group. I decided it was all under the control of groups now, whether it's business, religion, political people, or what, and I would distance myself from wishing for a good outcome. Let it do what it's going to do, yeah. And I'll enjoy it as an entertainment.
And I'll reflect on what it is on its own.
Another fella who wrote his book on the study of crowds in, I believe, 1896 was a Frenchman named Gustave Le Bon. His book, The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. He's got some very interesting quotes in here as well. He said that the art of those who govern consists above all in the science of employing words. The image is evoked by words, being independent of their sense. They vary from age to age and from people to people, the formulas remaining identical. Certain transitory images are attached to certain words. The word is merely, as it were, a button of an electric bell that calls them up. Talk about word magic, and you could get really esoteric with this quote. I mean, right before a spell, what do? You quote words, phrases. Now, he also goes on to say that the masses have never thirsted after truth. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master, and whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. I think many of us can attest to that because we've been kind of calling out people for a long time and telling people that both sides of the political bird were corrupt and talking about the frauds in science and academia and religion and all kinds of other things. And people didn't want to listen, and they called us crazy. And we don't seem so crazy anymore, do we? Now, Gustav goes on to say that all the civilizations we know have been created and directed by small, intellectual aristocracies, never by people in the mass. The power of crowds is only to destroy. And we talk about Walter Lippmann and his kind of ideology about the people. Now, he was a little less authoritarian, in a sense, than Edward Bernays, but he did think that the crowd could never be quite intelligent enough to make its own decisions. We'll get into that a little bit later. Gustave Le Bon goes on to say that we see, then, that the disappearance of the conscious personality, the predominance of the unconscious personality, the turning by means of suggestion and contagion of feelings and ideas in an identical direction, the tendency to immediately transform the suggested ideas into acts. These, we see, are the principal characteristics of the individual forming part of the crowd. I mean, we can think about that, especially during election time, like it is right now, but really the last 20 years, 30 years or so, just the way people have become so divided and so obsessive over their politicians and their political ideologies. We see that is very true. Now, I have another quote by Alex de Tocqueville from Democracy in America. And he said that after having thus successfully taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioning him at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which most of the original minds and the most energetic characters cannot penetrate to rise above the crowd. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals of which the government is the shepherd. I mean, can anyone argue with that at this point? I know many of you who are listening certainly are not timid sheep, but we are surrounded by people who become timid sheep, often thinking that they are standing up for freedom. And this series is as much about democracy as it is about propaganda. What I aim to kind of put across is that you could not have the type of democracy, wink wink, that we have without mass propaganda. And I think that these next words by Edward Bernays proves it. We go back to him writing his book so long ago, and now we have all this technology that the elites and their strategists can use to mind control the citizens and nudge them in the ways that they want them to go. So Edward Bernays says that Democracy means the people are in charge. The majority rules. The people, i.e. the majority, can be swayed. Therefore, democracy means that those who can sway the people are in charge. Those who influence the majority rule. The minority, he explains, has discovered a powerful help in influencing majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the minds of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. As civilization has become more complex, and as the need for invisible government has been increasingly demonstrated, the technical means have been invented and developed by which opinion may be regimented. The systematic study of mass psychology revealed to students the potentialities of invisible government of a society by manipulation of the motives which actuate man in the group. We have voluntarily agreed to let an invisible government sift the data and high-spot the outstanding issues so that our field of choice shall be narrowed to practical proportions. From our leaders and the media they use to reach the public, we accept the evidence and the demarcation of the issues bearing upon the public's questions. From some ethical teacher, be it a minister, a favorite essayist, or merely prevailing opinion, we accept a standardized code of social conduct to which we conform most of the time. And then he goes on to say that propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government. Remember that term invisible government as we go on here. Teddy Roosevelt basically confirmed what Bernays said there with his quote, "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people." We know Teddy Roosevelt was a member of the elite Skull and Bones Order. Was he talking about Skull and Bones? Was he talking about some other organization or group? Let's go on. The 96th mayor of New York City from 1918 to 1925, his name was John Francis Hyland, and in his autobiography, he said, "They practically control both parties. They write political platforms, make cat's paws of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business." Again, everything we've seen, the collusion of big business, think BlackRock, Blackstone, the Gates Foundation, Microsoft, Google, I mean, it goes on and on, but we know that is absolutely 100% correct. Now, let's get back into Walter Lippmann. I think these are some important quotes from him. This is from his Phantom Public book. I believe this one came out in 1925. He said that this democratic conception is false because it fails to note the radical difference between the experience of the insider and the outsider. It is fundamentally askew because it asks the outsider to deal as successfully with the substance of a question as the insider. He cannot do it. No scheme of education can equip him in advance for all the problems of mankind. No device of publicity, no machinery of enlightenment, can endow him during a crisis with the antecedent, detailed, and technical knowledge which is required for executive action. The democratic idea has never defined the function of the public. It has treated the public as an immature, shadowy executive of all things. The confusion is deep-seated in a mystical notion of society. The people were regarded as a person, their wills as a will, their ideas as a mind, their mass as an organism with an organic unity of which the individual was a cell. Thus, the voter identified himself with the officials. He thinks that their thoughts were his thoughts, that their deeds were his deeds, and even that in some mysterious way, they were part of him. All this confusion of identities led naturally to the theory that everybody was doing everything. It prevented democracy from arriving at a clear idea of its own limits and attainable ends. I think the quote has been attributed to Ben Franklin, but probably others as well. Something like, democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner. And we can talk about the problems with other forms of government as well, but we're focusing on democracy right now because it's all we hear about in the news. It's the clarion call of the Democrats and even a lot of the Republicans now. It's why we go overseas and rebelize and overthrow governments under the guise, under the banner of spreading democracy. And so I think it's very important to understand what they actually mean by democracy. I think many of you understand now that it's the liberal world order. It's what they want to do financially. It's what they want to do militarily. It's a game of conquering. And so when they say democracy, they mean conquest. Now, Littman goes on to say that it obscured for the purposes of government and social education the separation of function and the specialization in training, which have gradually been established in most human activities. Democracy, therefore, has never developed an education for the public. It has merely given it a smattering of the kind of knowledge which the responsible man requires. It has, in fact, aimed not at making good citizens, but at making a mass of amateur executives. It has not taught the child how to act as a member of the public. It has merely given him a hasty, incomplete taste of what he might have to know if he meddled in everything. The result is a bewildered public and a mass of insufficiently trained officials. The responsible men have obtained their training not from the courses in civics, but in the law schools and law offices and in business. The public at large, which includes everybody outside the field of his own responsible knowledge, has had no coherent political training of any kind. Our civic education does not even begin to tell the voter how he can reduce the maze of public affairs to some intelligible form. And finishing up, he says, a false idea of democracy can lead only to disillusionment, to meddlesome tyranny. If democracy cannot direct affairs, then a philosophy which expects it to direct them will encourage the people to attempt the impossible. They will fail, but that will interfere outrageously with the productive liberties of the individual. The public must be put in its place so that it may exercise its own powers, but no less, and perhaps even more, so that each of us may live free of the trampling and the roar of the bewildered herd. And you guys remember that Littman was an American Fabian, one of the early founding members of the Council on Foreign Relations, worked for the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, was very close to the Dulles brothers, and remained so, I believe, the rest of his life. I found an declassified document where Alan Dulles had written Littman about an oil pipeline. It was kind of interesting. I've just read over it a little bit, and you could tell that these guys were looking out for each other, and everything leads back to money. So I guess if you are in one of those three-letter agencies, you know how to play it in your favor. And that's probably one of the biggest problems with our country. But I don't want to get off on a tangent. I think that we can see right now the public is being played as much or more than they've ever been played. It reminds me, when I read about the early 1900s, it really reminds me of that time. And that's when Littman and Bernays and George Creel were working for the CPI, the Committee on Public Information, which was a propaganda agency. And they really figured out under that time and that program how to manipulate the masses. They perfected it. And they've been using those techniques ever since. And so I think it's really important that we understand these techniques as we go forward, because it feels like we're almost at war with the way propaganda has ramped up so much. And obviously what's going on with Israel decimating Gaza, and our leadership and our representatives passing new laws to keep us from complaining about it and pointing out the corruption, the evil deeds. It's really a crazy time to be alive. So I think we need to know about these propaganda techniques and all the different techniques that are connected to it. Now, next, we're going to talk about the term the invisible government, because something jumped out at me, and it may not even be connected, but earlier we spoke of Bernays talking about the invisible government. And I thought about it, and I realized that they call the Rosicrucians the invisible college, or the invisibles. Let's read a little bit here, okay? Knights of the helmet, aurum solis. Check this out. I just think this is interesting. The members of this secret literary society were known as the Knights of the Helmet. They had a series of ethical rituals created by Francis Bacon and were initiated with an elaborate ceremony which included a vow, resuscitatives, and perambulations. The initiate was capped with the helmet of Pallas to denote he was henceforth an invisible. In classical mythology, the cap of invisibility, also known as the dogskin of Hades, is a helmet or cap that can turn the wearer invisible, also known as the cap of Hades or helm of Hades. Wearers of the cap in Greek myths include Athena, the goddess of wisdom, also known as Minerva, the messenger god Hermes, and the hero Perseus. Those wearing the cap become invisible to other supernatural entities, akin to a cloud of mist sometimes used to remain undetectable. Isn't that interesting? Do you want to know more? Because I want to know more. The mythos goes that out of sadness and regret, Athena, or Minerva, created the Palladium, which was a statue in the likeness of Pallas, the daughter of Triton and her lesbian lover. Wrapped in the Aegis, which she had feared about the breast of it, she set up beside Zeus and honored it. Later, Athena took on the title Pallas as a tribute to her late friend. Now let's look here at a Francis Bacon website. Now hang with me here, guys. I know this is going off the subject at hand, which is democracy propaganda, but I promise that it will all kind of connect once we're done. It's interesting when you go on this website, sirbacon.org, it has the number 33 right in the middle at the top. And why wouldn't it? And this says that the image of Pallas Athena, the spear shaker, guardian of the mysteries, and this is from the title page of Bacon's 1641 book, Wisdom of the Ancients. Now, if you guys don't know, many people think that Sir Francis Bacon was the real Shakespeare, or at least one of the main writers of Shakespeare. Also, many people think that he was possibly the founder, one of the co-founders of Rosicrucianism, and many, many also think that he was the inspiration for Freemasonry. Now, let's look here. He has a drawing of Pallas Athena, and it explains it here. The illustration depicts Pallas Athena, or Minerva, seated on a small stage, the stage of the mysteries, over which she and her male counterpart, Apollo, preside. In her right hand, she holds her famous spear. Her name literally means spear shaker or Shakespeare, while her left hand rests on the top of her polished shield. She wears her aegis, or breastplate, and her plumed helmet, symbol of illumination. Manufactured for her by Pluto, god of the underworld, it is this helmet which she bestows on all her heroes who attain the quest, who thereby become knights of the helmet, representing their illumination. It also signifies secrecy, and invisibility. The name William or Wilhelm is derived from this symbolism. Inscribed on Athena's shield is a Latin motto, Obscurus vera involvens, meaning truth is enveloped in obscurity, which explains the imagery on the shield, the central sun representing truth, and the surrounding clouds, obscurity. Above Athena's head are three lamps, each burning with a lighted candle, signifying the Holy Trinity. The Latin motto associated with them, written on a scroll, hovering directly over the goddess's head, reads, Sic fulgate in umbras, which translates as, Thus it shines in the shadows, a hint that the light of truth shines in the shadows of the world in an obscured and veiled way. This way is shown here as associated with the stage, the theater of the mysteries, on which the allegorical dramas of life were enacted in classical times under the auspices of the goddess Pallas Athena, the archetypal Shakespeare. This was the primary method of education by means of which the ancient wisdom was taught. The wisdom of the ancients devised a way of inducing men to study truth by means of pious frauds, the delicate Minerva secretly lurking beneath the mask of pleasure. That was Richard de Bury, High Chancellor of England. Bacon, a great admirer of the theater for such purposes, who invariably put into practice whatever he thought was useful for the good of humanity, said he was going the way of the ancients. He was even referred to as Athena by his literary contemporaries. If none but the worthy should mourn your death, O Bacon, none, trust me, none will there be. Lament now sincerely, O Clio, and sisters of Clio. Ah, the tenth muse and glory of the choir has perished. Ah, never before has Apollo himself been truly unhappy. That was a tribute to Bacon from an anonymous writer. And we can go a little bit further into this symbolism. Isn't it interesting as we talk about Pallas Athena, Bohemian Grove, right? Their motto is, Weaving spiders come not here. And that is a line from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Shakespeare, of course, as we just said, being an epithet of the Arcadian goddess Pallas Athena, whose shaking spears signaled war as decreed by the oracles of Delphi. We also have the owl at Bohemian Grove. And you think about the Bavarian Illuminati. What was their sign? Well, it was, besides the point within the circle, it was the owl of Minerva. Isn't it weird that you see these connections here? We'll talk a little bit more about this symbolism. I believe it was the Freemasonry episode we did, number 2, that we talked in detail more about Pallas Athena and the Palladium Order. But let's look back at that, because that's been a long time ago. This is encyclopedia.com. Order of Palladium, said to have been a Masonic order, also entitled the Sovereign Council of Wisdom, founded in Paris on May 20th, 1737. It initiated women under the name of Companions of Penelope. As proof of its existence, Jean-Marie Ragon, the Masonic antiquary, published its ritual. Palladium was also one name used by Leo Taxil, or Gabriel Johann Pajat, to refer to the Masonic order he made a part of his 1880s hoax, which was aimed at showing that the Roman Catholic Church secretly sponsored Freemasonry. We went into detail on that episode. I was all about there being a Palladium order because I'd heard so much about it. But when I really got to looking, I never found any proof that Albert Pike belonged to that order. I did find quite a bit of proof that Leo Taxil was a hoaxer who was a Mason, then he was telling on the Masons, and then he was a Catholic, and then he was telling on the Catholics, or some sort of order like that. So he sounded to me like he was one of these guys that just wanted a lot of attention. So I'm open to it still, But I've never seen any information, and I've seen a lot of people still try to say that it's true without providing any proof whatsoever. Now, we'll get back to that symbolism in a minute. I want to focus on the idea of democracy being perhaps a religion more than just an idea, something that actually dates back to a long time ago. Now, this was January 3rd, 2021. This is Nancy Pelosi, a speaker of the House. She says, "Thank you, my friends, members of Congress, family and friends. Welcome all. As a speaker of the House, it is my great honor to preside over this sacred ritual of renewal as we gather under the dome of this temple of democracy to begin the 117th Congress." That's pretty esoteric, if you ask me. Now, this is Manly Palmer Hall. We're going to look at a few of his quotes on democracy. He was a 33rd degree Mason and Rosicrucian, wrote all kinds of books on the occult and esoteric beliefs. And he said that more than 3,000 years, secret societies have labored to create the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of all enlightened democracy among the nations of the world. World democracy was the secret dream of the great classical philosophers. Thousands of years before Columbus, they were aware of the existence of our Western Hemisphere and selected it to be the site of the philosophical empire. The brilliant plan of the ancients has survived to our time, and it will continue to function until the great work is accomplished. We've talked about the great work and the connection to Tikkun Olam and Judaism, but let's go on here. Men bound by a secret oath to labor in the cause of world democracy decided that in the American colonies they would plant the roots of a new way of life. Brotherhoods were established to meet secretly, and they quietly and industriously conditioned America to its destiny for the leadership in the free world. Benjamin Franklin exercised an enormous philosophical influence in colonial politics as the appointed spokesman of the unknown philosophers. He did not make laws, but his words became law. World democracy was the secret dream of the great classical philosophers toward the accomplishment of this greatest of all human ends. The outlined programs of education, religion, and social conduct directed to the ultimate achievement of practical and universal brotherhood. And in order to accomplish their purposes more effectively, these ancient scholars bound themselves with certain mystic ties into a broad co-fraternity. Think about maybe the Universal Co-Masons as well, who I believe are very influential nowadays, but you don't hear much about them. He goes on to say that these orders were created also in Egypt, Greece, India, and China. Orders of initiated priests and philosophers were formed as a sovereign body to instruct, advise, and direct rulers of states. That's quite a saying there, isn't it? One of the most ancient of man's constructive ideas is the dream of a universal democracy, a cooperation of all nations in a commonwealth of states. The mechanism for the accomplishment of this idea was set in motion in the ancient temples of Greece, Egypt, and India. So brilliant was the plan, and so well was it administered, that it has survived to our time, and it will continue to function until the great work is accomplished. I think that is the same quote we read earlier, just kind of rewritten. But Hall dedicates that book to democracy. I think that is the secret destiny of America. He goes on to say that the security that the world seeks cannot be bestowed. It must be earned. When a sufficient number has attained this degree of true leadership, the imperishable democracy of the sages will become a fact in the mortal sphere. That one was from America's Assignment with Destiny. Now, this is Joseph D. Maistre. He was a diplomat of Sardinia. He said that to hear these defenders of democracy talk, one would think that the people were deliberate like a committee of wise men, whereas in truth they were judicial murderers, foolhardy undertakings, wild choices, and above all, foolish and disastrous wars, which are eminently the prerogatives of this form of government. We're talking about the CPI a minute ago, the Committee on Public Information, and we're going to be covering on one of the episodes for this series, the CPI, in detail. And several of their agents talked openly about a religion of democracy, or Americanism as they called it also. And they thought that it was America's destiny, and in America as a country, it was our duty to spread democracy across the world. Remember, in Walter Lippmann's book on public philosophy, he said that the First War was supposed to be the start of spreading world democracy. After all, the motto of the war was making the world safe for democracy. Then we think about the two shows we did. I think they were called Democracy is My Business and Business is Good. And they were about the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created by the CIA, and they tout spreading democracy, and that's what they do in this global democracy project started in the 80s. But what they actually seem to do is fund all of these NGOs to foment trouble in these other countries, because wherever they are, there's often overthrows of governments and regime changes. So again, what do they really mean by democracy? Aldous Huxley said this. He said that, by means of ever more effective methods of mind manipulation, the democracies will change their nature. The quaint old forms, elections, parliaments, supreme courts, and all the rest will remain. The underlying substance will be a new kind of totalitarianism. All the traditional names, all the hallowed slogans, will remain exactly what they were in the good old days. Democracy and freedom will be the theme of every broadcast and editorial. But meanwhile, the ruling oligarchy and its high-trained elite of soldiers, policemen, thought manufacturers, and mind manipulators will quietly run the show as they see fit. Again, can we apply that to now and to what we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years? I think we absolutely can. All right, guys, we're coming up on the end of the episode. Now, what I want to play next is a couple of rather long clips, and I do apologize, but I think that they kind of help us wrap up this episode. The first one we've played a piece of before, and it is the opening ceremony of the National Endowment for Democracy. It was in the 1980s, I believe 1983. It was a bipartisan effort, and you can hear Ronald Reagan speaking about it. And then we hear from former and late CIA agent Philip Agee, who explains more about what the National Endowment for Democracy really is and what it means to the CIA and to the government, really. And that is influencing other governments, getting in there and controlling them. Not for the benefit of us, mind you, but for the benefit of whomever they are loyal to. And I think it all goes back to money, influence, and conquest.
It's a great honor for those of us who are involved with the National Endowment for Democracy to be here this morning to participate in this gathering and to have you celebrate this occasion with us, you and the Vice President. We're very grateful for that and very honored. We have here an initiative that came from President Reagan in this administration on a concept that is absolutely essential in the judgment of many people who are on the board for the National Endowment and many other people in this country. It is a great opportunity and a great challenge. I don't believe that any time in the history that I've been in the Congress in 30 years, we've ever had coming together the kind of political leadership, the economic and labor leadership, and the leadership that is represented on the board of the National Endowment to carry out a national objective of this kind. Democracy is a vibrant, living thing that needs to be explained, promoted, nurtured, and encouraged. The board here, Mr. President, is an outstanding board. I submit. We understand the challenge that has to be carried out. We are prepared to meet that challenge because we recognize the importance to the United States and to the world.
Good morning and welcome. It's good to have you all here to help celebrate the launching of a program with a vision and a and a noble purpose. The National Endowment for Democracy is, just as we've been told, more than bipartisan. It's a genuine partnership of Republicans and Democrats, of labor and business, conservatives and liberals, and of the executive and legislative branches of government. It's such a worthwhile, important initiative that I'm tempted to ask, why hasn't it been done before? Well, we're doing it now, and it's largely because of the hard work of good people. Chuck Manatt, Frank Fahrenkopf, Dante Fascell, Bill Brock, Lane Kirkland, Mike Samuels, you have my heartfelt thanks and warmest congratulations. And a special thank you to our vice president, who has been carrying this message for quite some time now on missions here and there throughout the world. The establishment of the National Endowment goes right to the heart of America's faith in democratic ideals and institutions. It offers hope to people everywhere. Last year in London, I spoke of the need and obligation to assist democratic development. And my hope then was that America would make clear to those who cherish democracy throughout the world that we mean what we say. What had been preying on my mind that prompted me to say that in that speech to the Parliament was that in my lifetime, my adult lifetime, the world has been beset by isms. And we remember one of those isms that plunged us into a war. And it suddenly dawned on me that we, with this system which so apparently works and is successful, have just assumed that the people would look at it and see that it was the way to go. And then I realized, but all those isms, they also are missionaries for their cause, and they're out worldwide trying to sell it. And I just decided that this nation, with its heritage of Yankee traders, we ought to do a little selling of the principles of democracy. Speaking out for human rights and individual liberty and for the role of a rule of law and the peaceful reconciliation of differences, for democratic values, principles, is good and right, but it's not just good enough. We must work hard for democracy and freedom, and that means putting our resources, organizations, sweat, and dollars behind a long-term program. Well, the hope is now a reality. The National Endowment for Democracy, a private, nonprofit corporation funded by the Congress, will be the centerpiece of this effort. All Americans can be proud of this initiative and the congressional action which made it possible. By engaging the energies of our major political parties, of labor, business, and other groups such as the academic community, the forces of democracy will be strengthened wherever they may be. They'll have a caring group of Americans to go to get assistance from, advice, and cooperation. This program will not be hidden in shadows. It'll stand proudly in the spotlight, and that's where it belongs. We can and should be proud of our message of democracy. Democracies respect individual liberties and human rights. They respect freedom of expression, political participation, and peaceful cooperation. Governments which serve their citizens encourage spiritual and economic vitality, and we will not be shy in offering this message of hope. Through the National Endowment, the private sector will promote exchanges between the American people and democratic groups abroad. It'll stimulate participation in democratic training programs and institution building overseas. The endowment will work closely with those abroad who seek to chart a democratic course. And all this work will be sensitive to the needs of individual groups and institutions. And of course, it will be consistent with our own national interests. The National Endowment will let the people at the grassroots who make our democracy work help build it elsewhere. And the organizations that are now being formed by the Republican and Democratic parties and by labor and business will be the key to success. They'll also be expressions of what's best and most valuable in American public life.
And so nowadays, instead of having just the CIA going around behind the scenes and trying to manipulate the process secretly by inserting money here and instructions there and so forth, they have now a sidekick, which is this National Endowment for Democracy, NED.
Yeah.
And this organization dates from 1967. A lot of people don't realize, because it was just established in, 83, or so, but the idea emerged from a series of scandalous revelations in 1967, the worst ones to that point, to hit the CIA. And I was in headquarters at the time that these scandals broke, and the gloom there was something you could touch almost. Because what happened was the long-running CIA's control and manipulation of the international program of the National Students Association in this country, which was the National Organization of University Students, came out. It was revealed. And that led to revelations of a lot of other CIA operations, because they were using the same bogus and real foundations to channel money into all these different overseas organizations. And I remember very well that Time magazine at the time, or Newsweek, I think it was Time, they published a wheel with all these spokes going out, and the CIA was at the center, and then halfway out were all these foundations, American organizations, and then out at the end were the foreign groups that got the money, and the instructions. Naturally, they don't give away money without being sure that it's spent the way they want it spent. And so this was a catastrophe for the CIA. And the next month, or the month after that, this started in February of '67, and then by April, I think it was, Dante Fachel, the congressman from Florida, was proposing the establishment of an open system to finance these overseas organizations. And we're talking about some government organizations abroad, some political parties, some media organizations, youth organizations and student organizations, all these kinds of so-called pluralist organizations, when in fact they weren't really free organizations, because to the degree that they take money and instructions from the CIA, to that degree they're not free at all, right? But anyway, Fachel came up with this idea, but it didn't go anywhere, because the so-called consensus between the two parties had broken down over Vietnam. And so it wasn't until the early 80s, when Reagan made his speech in the House of Commons about the democracy project worldwide, that this began to take on steam again. And finally, they decided to copy the German example. Each of the major German political parties has a foundation which is financed by the German government. Before it was West Germany, now the whole country. And for example, the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung is the SPD, or the Social Democratic Party's foundation. And they finance projects all over the place. And for years in the 50s and 60s, and I would guess even into the 70s, in fact, I know into the 70s, even to the early 80s, the CIA was channeling money through these German foundations abroad. For example, some money, a lot of money, I think it was $1 million or more, but I'm a little hazy on the amount. But anyway, it was CIA money which went through the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, that's the Christian Democratic Union. It went from there to IVEPO, which is a foundation of the COPE, the Christian Democrats in Venezuela. Oh. And from there, it went to the Christian Democrats in El Salvador, to Duarte, for use in the elections, I've forgotten which year, maybe 84 or something like that. And it was traced. Some journalists did this. And so that is the way they would use these German foundations in the past. So now we've got our own. We don't have to use the Germans unless we really want to anymore. Because in 1984, we established this National Endowment for Democracy, which is nothing but a mega conduit. And the millions, or the tens of millions, that are set aside for the meddling in the internal affairs of other countries goes to this conduit. It's like a bank account or something, but they have a board of directors and they do reports and stuff like that. But then it goes from there to one of four private foundations. One of the Democratic Party, one the Republican Party, or two, three the AFL-CIO, and four the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. These groups then pass it out to recipients in foreign countries. And in the Nicaraguan elections of 1990, I believe the figure was something like 12.5 million that went from the National Endowment for Democracy through these conduits to the UNO political movement there. It was the party, the coalition, you know, of UNO, which is the most ungodly coalition you can ever imagine.
Everything from communists all the way to Somocistas.
That's right. And then they had a trade union front, which also received money. And then they had this civic association. Civic association, I think they call it Via Civica there. That's an old technique of the CIA. is to establish a type of civic organization which will be involved in monitoring elections and things like that. And the first one that I know of was NAMFREL in the Philippines. They established that one around 1950-51 as part of the counterinsurgency against the Hux, the guerrilla movement of the time, because we wanted to have a vehicle for electing our man president of the Philippines. And we did it through this organization, NAMFREL. NAMFREL stands for National Association for Free Elections, I think.
Free.
And, free elections, when we were financing the whole thing.
No, guys, I hope, as always, that you got something real out of this episode that you can take with you and apply to your life and to looking at policies and politics. Now, I want to thank my patrons. And if you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/TheOddManOut. I want to thank Ann. I want to thank Anthony. I want to thank Cole. I want to thank Ashley. I want to thank that crazy bread man for being a covert co-conspirator. I want to thank Aaron. I want to thank Ruckus for being a producer of the show. Shout out to Ruckus. You can find him over at alternatecurrentradio.com or all over TNT Radio as well. Thank you to Bill for also being a producer of the show, and thank you to the mighty Kilowatt. Now I want to thank alternatecurrentradio.com for posting my show, and if you want to check out all their other fine podcasts, get on over to alternatecurrentradio.com. Thank you also to Fringe Radio Network for posting the show, and again, thank you all for listening. Cheers and blessings, and remember, their order is not our order. See ya.
Democracy basically means government by the people, of the people, for the people. But the people are retarded.